Welcome to the Voices of the West, hosted by Emil Franzi and dedicated to the principle that America was better off when our TV shows featured cowboys instead of lawyers.
Hi there. Going to do a little open phone time. Up to you if we can yak about whatever you feel like, 790-2040. But we're gonna play Drop the Needle, as we used to say back in the days when we had turntables. Back in the days when we had crystal sets, some of us are that old. I'm going to talk about, and I'm actually, what you guys are doing is you're making me put together a multiple recording, ultimately, of kind of a general overlay of all of the great Hollywood Western movie scores that I love to play, and most people kind of like to hear these, so it's kind of fun doing it about once a month, because there's all kinds of great American music, okay? While everybody else was off doing strange things in universities that nobody cared about when it came to writing music in this country, and there were a few guys who could knock out an opera now and then, but by and large, not really. Most of the major contribution to Western civilization, for want of a better term, and by Western civilization I mean a whole enchilada, not just that's what is west of the Mississippi, the Hollywood film scores, and particularly the Hollywood Western film scores, are some of the greatest music that were produced in this country in the 20th century, period. We've gone through the great guys, Teompkin, Steiner, Elmer Bernstein, a whole lot of others.
Many of them are very memorable as well.
Incredibly memorable. And what we're going to do now is we're going to go through some other guys that we missed. And I'm trying to boil this down to about a 90-minute presentation I can use in front of a group and probably, hopefully, at the next Western Writers of America conference. And it's going to be a real bear because the issue isn't finding enough good stuff. The issue is there's so much of it, and I never realized quite how much until I got into this, and I have now identified the music of over 200 composers who wrote and a phenomenal number of Western film scores, some of which are really great. Here's one that you shouldn't miss, okay? And you should be able to identify, if you think about it for a minute or two, hit it on the first. Put Bunker on the spot. Hey, Bunker.
I know what your question is.
Yeah, what is that?
It's familiar. I love it, and I can't place it.
We'll see if Frank Abel can pick it up. Frank, go for it.
I don't have that one.
Shane.
Really? Oh man, that's
my wife called that. I didn't believe her.
That's yeah. Victor Young's Song of the Faraway Hills from Shane. Victor Young died in 1956, had an Academy Award that year when Max Steiner, his old friend, finished off the score to Around the World in 80 Days, a movie you may recall.
Yes.
That was Victor Young's one Oscar for Best Film Score. But the guy could write a tune.
Yes.
Okay.
It sounds like the ending to Gunsmoke from the late 50s, early 60s, when they still had the wood.
Well, you had a genre in it. It's kind of like listening to, if you'll pardon the expression, either a Verismo opera or a Baroque Concerto Grosso. Is that Albinoni or Vivaldi or who is that? Mm. And they're all pretty damn good. And I just run this one by the other great score that I can remember of a Western score. Yeah, Victor Young wrote like 300 movie scores. Okay, he'd do 20 in a year. Okay, that's two a month, gang.
Yeah.
I mean, he could crank this stuff out like Schubert used to do songs, and one called The Brave One. I recall I've got the LP of that. That LP is worth all kinds of money because nobody's ever redone it. But it was just one of the second string movies Western movies that he did a score to. And the other one he did was Rio Grande. And I could just keep rolling them off if I just wanted to look on the sheets here. But you got the point. Guys?
Yes, indeedy. Hey, I want to listen to the show more than talk. But I wanted to give you a quick report from the ranch from the National Day of the Cowboy.
Oh, good. Do that. Hang on, Frank. Go for it, Bunker.
Well, we had probably about 30 plus people, and this, you know, we didn't really advertise it because we didn't actually put it together until like kind of the last minute. But we had, like I say, about 30 plus people. Van Flowers did a tour of the ranch, a dulcet tour, about an hour. Then we broke for our little lunch, our kind of brown bag lunch, and Bobby and Sally, both Sallys had some desserts there, Sally, the Sonoyta Sally, had a big bowl of macaroni salad, and everybody had their lunches and stuff. And then just a lot of social stuff. I did a little talk about the West, about the ranch, about the movies, and my career. And it was just a really great day down there. Beautiful weather, little humid, but, you know, a lot cooler than here.
Well, yeah, because it's one of the best places in Arizona, and don't let more people know or they'll move in.
Oh, I don't want them to move down there, but I want them to come down there.
Yes, sir. Yeah, you know what? We almost did because my father-in-law had two pieces of dirt, one in the Tortolitas and one down there, and it was a 50-50 call almost, and we went with the Tortolitas.
Well, they're both nice.
Yeah, they are.
They are. Tortolitas has got it's got its own special charm.
It was closer to downtown where my my mother-in-law and I both worked, and my wife later. So,
and whoever thought town would grow out to you?
Actually, up where I'm at, it's pretty well stagnant.
That's good.
Well, it's not good if you want to see your land be inflated so you can sell it for a Circle K, but it is if you like living there.
If you like the comfort and privacy.
Kind of like being on 20 acres. Don't like to see the smoke from a neighbor's chimney or hear his dog barking, except when I'm outside.
Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna listen to the show because this is one of my favorite segments.
Thank you, Bunker.
Okay.
And Frank, you still with us?
Yeah, Emil, we saw Bunker this morning down there. It was great.
Oh, super.
Hey, this is kind of off topic, but I've been waiting for a chance to tell you this anecdote that I read about, and I've been waiting for shows that this kind of fit, and it hasn't yet, so I was just going to barge in.
Go ahead.
Good friend of mine turned me on to Eugene Manlove Rhodes. I don't know if you've ever read any of his stuff. I hadn't.
No.
He's kind of, to literature, he's kind of what Charlie Russell is to painting. He was a cowboy in New Mexico in 1890, married right, ended up going to school, college. Probably the only cowboy writer I can accuse of ever writing literature. And great stuff. If you ever get a chance to read any of his stuff, mostly kind of short stories, but his signature work is called Paso por Aquí. And it's kind of a fictional work of what would happen if Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid ran into each other on friendlier terms.
Hey, Frank?
Yes,
email me that, will you?
Sure.
My home address? You've got it.
Absolutely.
Well, Frank,
you'll love this stuff.
Frank, they've already done that, the Tall Man television series.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Glogger and...
That's the guy who handed me my Lariat Award.
Oh, nice.
It was the MC.
Oh, cool. Yeah, and Pat, Pat Conroy, but I'm not sure that that's correct. But it, no, not Pat Conroy. Anyway, yeah, the tall man from 57, 58, something like
wow.
that.
Yeah. I'll definitely check that out. Anyway, the anecdote that Eugene Manlove Rhodes tells when he was cowboying is back in the day, Bull Durham, when you bought a package of the rolling tobacco, there'd be a little coupon in it. And for 10 or 20 coupons, you could remit those for a hardbound copy of a classic, Shakespeare, Chaucer. And the reason for that was that they were out of copyright and they were cheap to distribute. But as he cowboyed in southern New Mexico, line camps, tack rooms, bunkhouses, he'd find stacks of these classics. And he alleged that, and his writing kind of reflects this, it's a little bit like the series Deadwood. This stuff affected cowboys' speech back then. You know, you'd get some grizzled old guy that learned how to read by reading the Bard. And linguistically, it would affect their speech patterns. It was fascinating.
Yeah, it would. That's cool.
Anyway, yeah. I just thought I'd throw that
something
out.
Something has to explain why Dreyfus talks so funny.
I'm sure he's out there with Lisbon.
We can hope.
All right, gentlemen. Great show. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you, Frank. Let's take the break.
Voices of the West will be right back. Welcome back to Voices of the West.
Okay, we're back to Name That Tune.
So Barry Sullivan is who played with Clue Gulager in the Tall Man series. Two and a half seasons, I guess, and what did I see here? 1960 to 62. And
you know what? I don't even remember it.
Oh, my God. I love this show.
Well, that was back when there were 48 Westerns and we only had three stations.
Yeah, but I love this show, man. I like Clue Gulager.
Yeah,
this
I
is
do
before
too.
He went to the Virginian. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he is what I would have imagined Billy the Kid to have been like, you know, a free spirit. And I'm sure he was much worse, but that's kind of what I imagine there.
Hmm. Okay. All right. What are we doing now? Oh, I know what we're doing. You're going to hit the next film score. Catch some stylistic resemblance to the theme music of this radio show, which is from Jerry Morose's score to The Big Country. This is from Jerry Morose's score to, which one did we have up off that disc? Number one?
Yeah.
Which is?
Just says main title. I'm sorry there.
To what? The Jayhawkers?
I can read it here. Cam? Oh, The Jayhawkers Suite, yes.
Yeah, it's from The Jayhawkers. Which is a pretty good movie, by the way. Morose was a very interesting guy. He was one of the few Hollywood film composers who actually did things like write operas and symphonies and all kinds of other music. And I guess he picked up his bucks by coming into Hollywood. But I used to think it was a little strange that a guy who lived in New York City would hop on a plane, fly out to Hollywood for a month, write a film score like this one or like some of the other really great Western scores, and then just fly back home. Well, it turns out when he was a young man, he spent a year in New Mexico. And he really got to loving the country, and he really got to having a definite feeling about the big feel of the mountain country of New Mexico, the stuff around Ruidoso and all the rest of it. And he carried that with him for the rest of his life, and he did have a good feel for a Western, and was a damn good composer, I might add. And he did a couple of those. He ended up with television scores. I can't remember which one it was right off the top of my head. It's not on my notes. Anyhow, that's Jerry Maross, and we got Bunker back.
Apologize for calling back, but I
just
had
to. Oh, no biggie.
Frank was talking about Eugene Manlow's Rhodes, and this guy is just so fantastic because he was like a contemporary of Owen Weiser and much better writer. I've got one of his novels and a couple of his books on short stories, and he really wrote the idiom. His family had a ranch, which is up on the north end of the White Sands, New Mexico, not too far from Ruidoso, and pretty close to Carrizosa. Once a year, they open up the sands, and they let people caravan back up in there to the ranch. It's almost like a shrine in New Mexico. But this guy, his writing is like Charlie Russell's Trail Piled Under or Ross Santee's books, who's one of the great Western writers of Arizona. This guy is, they're just unbelievable, their accuracy, the color, the idiom, and just the way it really was.
Cool.
And Harry stole my thunder. I was going to call him to tell you that it was Barry Sullivan, but Harry's just too quick on the draw.
Well, you know what? What we have here is people say, well, when you see Jimmy Cagney, for example, in a Western, or mm-hmm. Edward G. Robinson, or these guys who have a notorious East Coast New York or whatever accent, excuse me, when the West was then, like 1872, there wasn't anybody with a Western accent because there wasn't anybody, unless he was a Comanche.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, well, Billy the Kid was born in New York.
Bingo! So these people all talked like where they came from. Well, where they came from was England, Ireland, New York, Illinois, wherever.
Germany.
And it takes two or three generations for those accents to become part of the process.
And you look at the merchants of the West, an awful lot of them were of the Hebrew extraction.
Oh, sure. Look at the Goldwaters.
Exactly. It's a perfect example.
So when you say it's not believable to have a movie with Jimmy Cagney and it sounded like Jimmy Cagney did in a gangster flick, I got a clue. What's really not believable, if you look at it correctly, is anybody that sounds like, Sam Elliott walking around in about 1850, because they didn't talk that way then.
No, it's kind of what I call, it's like they didn't talk that way, but we wish they did.
That's right. Thank you very much.
It's like True Grit, the one with John Wayne. Nobody spoke like that, but that's the way they should have. It was a stylized thing that they did for the movie.
Actually, what they did, now what's interesting about Portis and True Grit is he worked for the phone company, the author of the original novel, mm-hmm. in Arkansas in the 1830s. In the 1930s. And the people he was talking to did talk that way.
Yeah.
Because that's what you talked like when you lived in Arkansas then.
And
True Grit was supposed to be the original in the novel, not the movie, was Arkansas across the line in Oklahoma.
Right, because everybody forgets that Arkansas was right there on the border to the west and was actually part of the West.
It was. Yeah, Trans-Mississippi, hello.
Yeah, my second stepdad was full-blooded Choctaw from Arkansas.
All right, well, let's go to...
more music.
Okay, well, we'll take a quick call from Ira. Go for it.
Hi, I wanted to ask Emil, you and Harry a question, but first I was going to mention, I have an old letter from my grandfather who lived in Boston from about 1950, and he's writing my dad, and he says, I'd like to join you in Tucson, son, but how's the Indian situation? So that kind of cracked me. I still have the letter. All the Western movies and everything really
got me. Right. You never know, you know?
So the other thing, maybe you guys can remember, there used to be, and I've been meaning to ask you this a long time, there was, I think it was only one year on television, there was this Indian chief that was sheriff of a white town. I think it was, his name was White Horse or something like that. Do you remember, he had long flowing white hair and he was a sheriff of a white town. Do you remember who, name of it or anything?
You got me on that one.
It was really interesting. It was really a unique show. It just I only lasted a year or two, but it was one heck of a...
We flooded the market back then with probably more Westerns than we could absorb.
Yeah, this would
hopefully we'll do the same now with lawyers, and we'll get rid of them and move on to something real.
This was about 1962. Do you remember, Harry, the show or anything? He may not be listening.
He's on the other line.
So I don't know. Ask Harry if he remembers.
What was the question?
It was
I was
one
on
or
the
two
horn.
Years. He was a Indian chief, and he was the sheriff of a white town. He had long, flowing white hair.
White Horse.
I'm looking it up, or trying to look it up on
something like that. White on, Horse, or something, or Big Horse, or
on IMDb, and I'm not having much luck here.
Oh, do you remember seeing it though?
No. I
neither
don't.
One of us do.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Hit the next one. Whatever. Maurice Jarre is the name of the composer, best known for Lawrence of Arabia, and big on percussion, as you can tell. This is from, I believe, The Condor, and we've also got one, he'll probably, it sounds pretty much the same, cut from the same cloth. His score to The Professionals, one of my really favorite movies, because anything with Lee Marvin and Burt Lancaster in the same flick is worth the trip, not to mention a few other people. And he also did Via Rides and a few others. This was an interesting guy to have scoring movies that were set in the border country. You know, South Texas, northern Mexico, whatever. Don't know how well he did if you gave him Canada. Okay? But he could write a tune, and he was a hell of a composer. So there. All right, we're going to grab a break, and we'll be back.
Voices of the West will be right back.
Hi folks, Stan Ivar here. This is John Carter on Little House A New Beginning to be exact, okay? And you're listening to Voices of the West.
Hi there, welcome back. Now what are we doing? Oh,
Newman?
Yeah.
This movie was on the Western's channel about the last week or so. The Bravados. Yeah, with Gregory Peck, Joan Collins. One of the best of the Vengeance movies, by the way. And the score's by Alfred Newman and Hugo Friedhofer. I'm not quite sure who did what, and probably neither are they. Because in those days, guys like Friedhofer, who finally won an Oscar for a movie, I can't remember which one, but he tended to be the second string guy who did the orchestrating for most of the other guys. For example, he orchestrated all of the 1938 wonderful film score by Eric Wolfgang Korngold of Robin Hood. That's a story in itself. It's not quite a Western story because it turns out Korngold only did one Western. But Korngold was in Vienna writing operas and not paying too much attention to a little thing called Adolf, as a Jew that probably wasn't the... Yeah, anyway, he had a gig doing some Hollywood music and he ended up going back to Vienna to do an opera, and he had turned down the Robin Hood score because he was too busy doing an opera. And the family was going, Eric, you know, it's getting a little tense out around Vienna now in 38 here. And he didn't pay attention, but he happened to be in the United States with all of his family, except for his dad and his oldest son, who were in Vienna. They were on the last train allowed into Switzerland the day of the German occupation, and got out. And all of a sudden, Eric wasn't going to be in Vienna doing operas anymore, so he checked in with his Hollywood connections and said, "Could I have that Robin Hood deal after all?" And they gave it to him, but he was going so fast. Pieces of Robin Hood are in some earlier classical music he wrote, and Friedhofer had to orchestrate the whole thing. And the net result of that was Korngold got the Oscar and Friedhofer isn't even in the credits. And he orchestrated probably the Bravados part we just heard from Newman. The Newman family, there's about eight of them, I think, Lionel and Randy and all the rest of them. And there's like grandchildren writing film music, okay?
That's nice.
Yeah, interesting people. All right, what's my next one?
We're going to do spaghetti westerns.
Okay, let's do this. No, don't tell him anymore, and hit number two on that one disc. Which one is that? It's number two, but I don't remember which movie that's from.
It says here, Guns Don't Argue.
Ennio Morricone, best known for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and that series with Clint and with How the West Was Won.
Henry Fonda.
And with Henry Fonda. One of the seminal figures in 1960s Western music, but most of these were Italian Westerns, like this one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this isn't particularly different than what you just heard from the Frenchman, Jarret. nor is it particularly different from a couple other guys we're going to get to before we get out of here.
I was going to ask, why do you think the spaghetti western has the rep that it has?
Two things happened at that time. First of all, it was gritty like it really was. It had two parts that were reality, and then you could forget the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But it has some interesting film music, because I've got another album of about six or seven other Italian composers who were writing spaghetti western scores. Some of them were pretty good. better than some of the operas they were doing by then. The Italians contributed one of the great thing to the western movie. All those reproduction firearms.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with, in the late 1950s, you had the first Navy Colts. And they did those by stamped parts, and then they would let people take them. The workers actually took them home and honed them down and put them back together. So you had the 18... The problem you had with most of the Westerns made up until the 1960s was it was getting tougher and tougher to have firearms with something other than a Winchester 92 or a,
right.
Colt, or a Colt Peacemaker. You didn't have any percussion weapons. Well, by the 1960s, it was exploded.
Mm-hmm.
I actually discovered the year where the Italian arms industry made more copies of Civil War weapons than we made during the Civil War. You want to know what the year was?
1975.
In 1983.
Yeah, I probably have one of them, too.
Yeah, me too. So
or two of them.
Yeah, and that's just been rolling and rolling and rolling, and I've got a copy of just about everything. Clint Eastwood, when he made Unforgiven, remember there were three guns in that movie that he purposely, Clint's pretty up on guns. He had a Star revolver, Civil War, which he carried. You had the Schofield carried by the kid, the punk who blew the guy away in the John, and he had the Spencer carbine.
Mm-hmm.
There were not any reproductions of those three guns being made at that time, 1992,
wow.
I believe.
Wow.
That's why he picked them. Guess what's happened since?
Now there's repros.
Oh, big time. Particularly with the Schofield and the Spencer. So that was the major contribution. The guns were real.
Hmm.
Also, they kind of dressed them scuzzy, and they used kind of scuzzy-looking towns that didn't look like some of the
movie sets.
Yeah, yeah. So, the stories were, they're kind of fun. You know, they weren't any further off than some other people were. They certainly weren't any worse than some of the crap that was produced in the 1970s. And I won't even go there. All right, hit the next one on Morricone. By the way, Morricone's 88 years old, still alive, living in Italy. Hey, if they can phone it in from New York City, okay? If the great Aaron Copland, left-wing communist gay Jewish boy from New York, can write all those ballets that guys like Elmer Bernstein and others wrote music sounding like, and can actually define that aspect of American music, and it was somewhat defined by Copland. So why can't this guinea get on the act, right? This is pretty. I just put it up to show the guy actually has a very broad style. And this is from Once Upon a Time in the West.
And if you close your eyes, you can see Claudia Cardinale.
Always something good to look at. You know the secret? Guy could write a tune. And in retrospect, other than the fact that he used some Jews' harps and some other strange percussion instruments, actually he's a pretty conventional composer. And a good one. That's really pretty, isn't it? Yeah, surprising. You think about that twangy crap at the beginning of Once Upon a Time in the West, and you don't realize that there's more. Now, one of the keys to a good film score is it's got to be more than a title and a couple of the things you just beat to death for an hour. This is a broad film score, and it's got a lot of good music in it. All right, let's grab another break.
Voices of the West will be right back. Welcome back to Voices of the West.
And just for the record, the bump music is Alfred Newman and Once Upon a Time in the West. No, excuse me. No, not Once Upon a Time in the West. That would be Morricone. Hollow West was one. Let's take a call from Jeff before we move up to the next.
Yeah, hi, Emil.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, one other distinction I've noticed. I only have an antenna TV, so I don't watch cable. And a couple of the channels now, you know, like, for instance, Channel 13 has three channels as opposed to one. And on those auxiliary channels, they have themes, comedy. One of them is Westerns. I believe it's Channel 13.3. So, I watch a lot of old Westerns. And the last night was Good, Bad, and the Ugly for the 100th time, or maybe the 500th time. I don't know. But one real distinction between the Italian Westerns and American Westerns, they don't preach gun control in the Italian Westerns. They almost exalt in the guns in Italian Westerns, as opposed, it's surprising how almost, I'll say 80 to 85% of the American Westerns, subtly or overtly or in your face, push gun control. I'll give you a good example. Destry Rides Again, one of the great Westerns. Yeah. Jimmy Stewart, Marlena Dietrich. That whole movie is about Destry not carrying a gun and how bad it is. You know, guns, you don't need guns for this, don't need guns for that, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, the movie climaxes with this monster gunfight in a saloon with about 500 guys and they're blazing it out. It settles whatever problem that is. I forget the exact problem that they were having.
Gotcha.
And he goes back to then preaching about how you don't need guns to do it. It's a sort of schizophrenic message. Another good one is one of my favorite movies, Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. And they do another thing that is really irritating. They edit out stuff that doesn't... I do want to say this. I hate to think it's true. But they have an agenda, and there's a great line in the Liberty Valance. I remember it because it was just so perfect. Jimmy Stewart says, why, Tom? Why'd you kill Liberty Valance? And Tom, that's a John Wayne, blows this blast of smoke right square in Jimmy Stewart's face and gives him this just hard look, and he says, he needed killing. They edit that out for, it apparently doesn't pass muscle.
That's one of the best lines in the movie.
You remember that line? I mean,
you're damn
so
straight. You got here. You got the Duke. You got Jimmy Stewart. They weren't exactly liberals, either one of them, guys.
Jimmy Stewart was a lawyer. Law and Order was, you know, the law was going to solve everything, all except for Liberty Valance. And then
Lee Marvin.
Oh, he was so great. And that guy was so good. You know, that's another thing. That guy must have made 500 movies, man. He shows up everywhere, and he is great in everything he does.
Lee Marvin, We've said about this out of him on this show. Lee Marvin is one of the actors. Brian Keith is this way, too. I can think of a few more. The movie is better for having them in it, whatever it is.
Whatever it is. Man, that's true for Lee. I like Brian Keith fine. I wouldn't put him in Lee Marvin's league, that's for sure. Lee Marvin, too. He's Tomboy, by the way. You knew that, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, after that, yeah, because I know Pam, and we've had her over to do some Empire Ranch stuff, and we did the Monty Walsh movie about 4 years ago.
Did you ever drink with him? He drank up the road here.
No, I never did. I ran into him a couple of times, but I never got to know him that well. I got to know Pam a little better when we asked her to help us when we put the Monty Walsh movie on at the Empire Ranch at the Loft about 4 years ago. And I visited their home on Campbell, where Pam still lives.
Well, listen, I'll get off of here, but I'm loving these old movie themes. They're obviously some great stuff. And
oh, there's an archive that's so deep that you'll be there forever.
Well, next time you watch just a movie on regular channel TV, you just pay attention, number one, for the editing. Number two, for the subtle gun control that's just...
And they're airbrushing the cigars out of Winston Churchill's photos.
Yeah, that's another one. Right? Nobody smokes all of a sudden, right?
Yeah.
Especially the good guys. Okay, nice talking to you guys.
Thank you, Jeff.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Go to Tom.
Yeah, I don't know if you might want to do this as a segment sometime where you discuss movies, good westerns that you don't hardly see or hear of anymore that are overlooked. I have a couple of candidates.
Go for it. We may have already done them. Try it. What do you got?
Apache?
With
Burt Lancaster.
Yeah, we did that one when we did Burt Lancaster, because Burt Lancaster made 15 westerns, and they're all pretty damn good.
Yeah. How about Lonely Are the Brave?
Kirk Douglas.
Yeah.
That was in the top 10. In fact, that was on the very first top 10 show we did in 2007, I believe.
Yeah.
And we did End of the West as the topic. And that was one of the, I think we, number one was Ride the High Country with Scott and McRae.
Yeah.
And Lonely Are the Brave was in there as number three or number four.
Yeah, it's not really a true 1870s.
Doesn't matter,
Western.
Still a Western.
It's a modern Western, I guess.
Yeah, like Junior Bonner up in Prescott's a Today Western or some others we can name.
One last little piece of trivia.
Yes, sir.
The movie with Alan Ladd and his son, where his son was playing a mute, he couldn't speak, and he had to have an operation. I think it was called The Young Rebel or something like that.
The Proud Ones. I can't remember the exact title. It had a Jerry Maross film score, by the way.
That's what I was going to point out. It was another Jerome Maross film score.
Who didn't do that many film scores. I think he made a he supplemented his income off of doing maybe one or two a year, unlike guys like Max Steiner or these guys who do 20, Victor Young. They do 20 film scores in a year. And you say, how can they do that? Well, they did.
Well,
and they're good.
I think Jerome probably borrowed heavily from his Big Country score on that one on the Alan Ladd one.
Well, he did some pretty good stuff. He had the same sound. And once again, if you take the whole Big Country score from beginning to end, and it's hard to get these things in where you get the full score. I mean, they really aren't out there. Big Country is one of them, where you can listen to 60 minutes or 70 minutes worth of music, and you say, damn, he wrote 60 or 70 minutes worth of music. He didn't just play the same stuff over and over.
Yeah, oh, no, it was good stuff, and you're right. He has a characteristic sound. As soon as you hear something that he wrote being played, you know that's his stuff.
Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Good call. Appreciate it. I got about 3 minutes. What are we at left? We might want to save it because I think it's a two-parter.
Yeah, sounds like a plan since I'm having troubles over here.
Okay,
equipment.
Can both of them out, and we'll come back and do it later because we got about 3 minutes left. Anybody want to call in? I wanted to get to Goldsmith Fielding. And Goldsmith and Fielding, at least. I could put Goldsmith and Fielding into another show and then come back in with Bruce Broughton and Basil Poledaris. Now, Paula Deris, you might know from two great film scores, which are knocked out of the park, which meant we were still doing this stuff well into this, at least at the end of the last century. Lonesome Dove and Quigley Down Under, two of the best film scores, Western film scores ever written. And I got to tell you, Silverado and Tombstone with Bruce Broughton aren't too shabby either. They're sitting right here, and I didn't get to them.
Great movies, too.
And, yeah, great movie. Well, you know what? A really good score gooses a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the difference between a good movie, Big Country, and a great movie, mm-hmm. Big Country. And a score to something like Lonesome Dove just puts that puppy over the top. That's why it's probably, in the sense that, in its own way, the Godfather 1 and 2 trilogy, and the 3 isn't as bad as some people think it is. It was a bit of an afterthought. Well, so was Rio Grande when it was attached to She Wore a Yellow Ribbon and Fort Apache is another great trilogy. But when you get into a different medium, and the medium was the miniseries, and the miniseries, which is what Tombstone was designed to be and should have been, and it would have been a much more solid presentation, able to compete with Wyatt Earp,
mm-hmm.
the Costner movie, which was supposed to be a trilogy on television,
mm-hmm.
and didn't come out that way, and they crammed it into too long a movie, and oh well. Parts of it are great, but the sum of its parts is less than the total. And that leaves us with an okay film score, but the score to Tombstone, the score to Lonesome Dove are over the top. They're just great music. Period. End of report. I said that, and I had this happen to a friend of mine who lost his son. And they couldn't listen to Lonesome Dove because it was too sad.
Mm.
It just triggered. It hurt
right.
at that time.
Mm.
And no one does longing better than Basil Poledaris, except maybe Puccini and Rachmaninoff. And I'll let it go at that one. And I seriously consider his music in the same category that I would Puccini and Rachmaninoff. It's a different genre. We do not appreciate it fully. The Brits appreciate it better. Their film composers and their real composers are the same guys. The same thing with the Russians. Prokofiev, Shostakovich wrote a lot of film music. You go to Britain, Vaughan Williams, Walton, all kinds of guys wrote a lot of film music. Bax and all their other great composers. Here, we had this total divide between academic guys over here and film guys over there. Okay. I'm done for the day. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Voices of the West.